I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest episode of Dead Rock Stars. I'm Joel McIver, author of many books, many, many articles, many, many interviews with the great and the good of rock music, and I'm here with my dear friend and comrade Mick Wall, who's done all that and many, many times more. And today, we will be talking about a rock star very close to our hearts.
So which icon, which dead icon are we discussing this week, Joel?
Well, this week we're looking back to, I want to say, Ireland's greatest ever rock star. Do you think that's going a bit too far?
Well, you know, Rory Gallagher, another very famous dead rock
star. Fantastic musician. Did he have the stature and the fame that this particular chap has?
He certainly did in Ireland.
Okay. All right, then shall we say someone who was unusual demographically, someone who traversed various styles of music before hitting on something that grabbed the pulse and the hearts of the nation?
Well, you can if you want. I don't know what any of that means. I'll tell you what he said to me once. Yeah. We were talking and I said...
Did he say Mick, you wanker?
Almost, yeah. I said, Phil... You and I have got a lot in common.
His name was Phil. That's a giveaway, right?
Yeah. I'm an Irish bastard too, because I am. Wall was my mother's name. And Lynott said, well, I'm not just an Irish bastard. I'm a black Irish bastard. Wow. So I win.
Oh, bloody hell.
Does that give it away?
I think it does. Everyone who's tuned in very, very kindly to the, you know, this podcast. It's
kindly.
The great, very late, sadly, Phil Lynott of Thin Lizzy. And I think earlier on, a moment ago, when I said that perhaps he was Ireland's greatest rock star, I did mean that quite seriously, but I rely more on my colleague Mick Wall to confirm or deny that, because he knew him.
Did
you not?
I did. I knew Phil.
In what capacity did you know him? You worked with him? Were you his friend? What was the score?
You ask me this every time if I was their
friend.
Perhaps
I shouldn't. Is that a silly question?
Well, yes, I think so, because, you know, once you are a famous rock star, yeah. I think you stop having friends and you get people that get to know you. Or people that you rely on. But your only real friends are the ones you knew before you were famous.
Because fame stops you being able to have genuine friends, is it like that?
I think so. You know, a friend is someone that you can be your worst self in front of.
I mean, I still have friends, and in my road, I'm really famous.
Yeah, but you don't have any friends.
No,
you didn't.
I'm not,
you know,
saying they're real.
Yeah, no. We're not talking Facebook friends, okay? We're
yes,
talking
course,
actual
yeah.
human
actual
beings
real friends.
That you ring on a Wednesday night and go, fancy a pint.
Now, did the great Lynott do this to you? Did he ever phone you up and say, how about a drink?
I'll tell you what he did do to me once. And as usual, we're leaping far ahead.
I do that. I'm sorry. I try to unnerve you at the start of every episode.
We were in the dressing room at the Marquee Club for a Wild Horses gig. Wild Horses was the band formed by Brian Robertson.
Yep.
The Thin Lizzy guitarist.
Later of Motorhead.
Played on Boys Are Back in Town and all the big hits. And his new band, Wild Horses, with Jimmy Bain, another dead rock star we will get to at some point. And Lynott said to me, Mick, are you into Fleetwood Mac? That's a terrible...
Ian,
cut that. Are you into Fleetwood Mac? I can't... Fuck me. I'm Irish and I can't... Okay, I'm not going to do it.
No, I think it was more like, are you into Fleetwood Mac? Aggressive southern
thing. He was more of a smoothie. He was, are you into Fleetwood Mac? I was like, Phil...
You sound like Sean Connery, mate. Are you into Fleetwood
Fuck
Mac?
Fuck off, Money Penny? Sean Connery. Are you into Fleetwood Mac?
Is any of this going to make it in?
Yes,
if it does, thank you so much for listening to us. We do appreciate it.
It gets better. No, Ian, leave all this in for crying out loud.
Leave all this in.
Now, that's a northern Irish accent. Phil famously was from Dublin.
He was from Dublin.
Crumlin in Dublin.
He was
and
Crumlin?
He said, Mick,
Do not edit this out.
Will you shut up talking to me? He said, "Are you into Fleetwood Mac?" And I was about 20 years old at the time. And I went, "Well, I really like the early stuff with Pink and Green." Yeah.
I love the chin.
And he went, "Ha, ha, ha, come here." And he pulled out a white packet.
Bloody hell.
And he unfolded it. And with a plectrum, he dug out a big load of powder.
A goodly portion.
Goodly portion. I went to shove it under my nose. And I was no stranger to such activities back then. However, there was something odd about this particular powder. And I said, what is it? And he went, "Fleetwood Mac.
God.
Smack." And I went, No.
Yeah.
And then he went, "I don't offer this to just anybody."
Christ.
So I did it.
Did you?
I did, yeah.
Did you realise that's both illegal and dangerous?
It was back then, and it still is now, and do not do this at home.
Kids. Bloody hell. Different times. Now, I was in preparation for our meeting today, Mick, to...
Does that make him my friend, though?
Seriously, it gives you a position of authority to talk about him, which many people do not have, which I think is the selling point, frankly, of this podcast, as well as my amazing radio voice, which is getting deeper and deeper. How many other people have the stories that you have about this man? And that's an example, I guess, of what we were talking about last time when we talked about John Bonham, and the time before that when we talked about Freddie Mercury. I was listening back to podcast in preparation for today, and I remember you saying times were different back then. People said, "Knock yourself out on cocaine, knock yourself out on all sorts of drugs. Watch out for the heroin, though. Just take it easy. You know, you can dabble."
That was the only no-no. I mean, you've got to remember in the 70s, offering somebody cocaine was similar to these days saying, "Would you like a glass of champagne?"
Mm.
We'd go to meetings in the... I was a PR in those days.
Yeah.
I was a partner in a company called Heavy Publicity. We did Thin Lizzy, Dire Straits, Black Sabbath, many, many big rock bands. And if you didn't turn up with cocaine, it was considered somewhat, you know, poor show.
It's mental, really, isn't it?
And in fact, on our invoices to the management or record companies, whoever was employing us, one of the items on the invoice was always champagne and flowers for the band, which meant coke, because that was the lingua franca
of
the times.
Lynott's poison of choice was the smack.
It was by that point. It didn't start out this way. I mean, I think we need to... Let's talk about the younger...
Should we do a timeline?
A little bit of a timeline, because Lynott was a tremendous artist, a very interesting man. The fact that he ended his days so tragically, essentially from a heroin overdose, although it was more complicated than that, we'll get into that.
Can I tell you a... I just butted in.
Of course, yes. That's not like you at all.
I have a story about Lynott from his very early days, which you may know.
Oh, go on.
But I quite like to share, because you may not know. The listeners may not know. As you may know, I'm the editor.
What was that, by the way?
What was what?
Oh, do you have to do that with, you know, that's not cool, man. That's not cool.
I should apologise for
Mac.
Now, listen, as you may know, I'm the editor of a magazine called Bass Guitar, and one of my writers... One of my writers is a fantastic woman called Ellen O'Reilly.
Oh, right.
Whose father, Patrick O'Reilly, whose late father, Patrick O'Reilly...
Scottish.
...ran a show band in Dublin.
All right.
It's a long story, which you can read about, actually, in Bass Guitar magazine, because I got Ellen to write about it when we were writing about Lynott. And it turns out that the show band that Patrick used to run, Lynott used to turn up to this. And this is when he was really young, 17 or 18, a young lad. Didn't play any instruments yet, but he showed an interest in the bass guitar, which was lying around on the stage. Patrick, fine man that he was, used to say, "Oh, come and have a play, Phil, you know, go and do whatever you want." And that's basically the end of the story. He played a bit of bass, showed an interest in playing, was given encouragement by this fellow, Patrick O'Reilly, the father of Ellen O'Reilly, my writer, and subsequently went on to his career. How about that?
Well, I guess if you like bass, that was quite a nice story.
Well, it's more than that. It introduced him to the stage. He was enabled to step onto the stage with a band, you know, because of this chap.
You mean it would never have happened if it hadn't been for Patrick?
Did I say that?
That's kind of where you're going with this.
No,
yeah.
No, you may read that into it. But,
No, I don't think... What else is there to read into that,
only
frankly?
Only that he was a kid who was interested in getting on stage, took the opportunity when it was given to him, and interestingly, it was a show band, you know, did these kind of cheesy
Irish show bands were about the only live entertainment you got in Ireland in those days. I mean, apart from folk clubs, where Lynott also honed his craft, as it were, with Eric Bell. the original Thin Lizzy guitarist.
Yeah.
They used to make more money doing folk songs in little clubs and boozers in Dublin than they did actually getting on stage and performing as Thin Lizzy in the early days.
Right.
Hence, a few years down the line, when they did Whiskey in the Jar, that was one of the songs they'd always done.
Traditional song.
Well, it was a Dubliners song, of a traditional old Irish song. Yeah.
So he was a folkie before he was a rocker.
He was a bit of everything. I mean, you know, these days, I think, post the 80s, post the whole kind of Kerrang, Headbangers Ball generation, Lizzy unfairly get lumped somewhat into the same bag as your Iron Maidens and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But in fact, that absolutely wasn't the case. Lynott grew up absolutely admiring and being hugely influenced by Van Morrison.
Yeah.
Hendrix, of course, but mainly as a role model, not as a guitarist. He was a poet. He published books of poetry.
Yeah, like you. I want to mention your poetry in every episode. Did the fucking producer just interrupt us?
The fucking producer.
Do you want me to come and press
buttons? Do you want us to swap places?
That's it.
Here? Lynott was like Bowie. That's what our producer has just told us. Of course, Lynott was famous for his mime with Lindsay Kemp. he also was very influenced by Anthony Newley. And his
the
first great...
The boys are back in town.
The boys are in outer space.
Just in case this has been edited out, listeners, our producer suggested earlier that perhaps Lynott had something in common with Bowie, which is why we're taking the piss.
Yeah. I don't think you need to do that, Joel.
No.
Just carry on, mate. You're so worried everything's going to get edited out. There's going to be nothing left in the programme.
I know.
Yeah, stop looking at him. Ignore him. When did he start chipping in? So shall I continue?
Well, if that's all right with you, Ian.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, you
Once
may.
Lynott got over his Bowie phase, he came to England with Thin Lizzy. They were signed to Decca. They released what in the early
Bowie
days...
Bowie was signed to Decca.
There you go. Case closed. Clinching fact. Anyway, early doors... Thin Lizzy combined that kind of Gaelic, folksy, traditional Irish sound with rock. So a bit like there was another famous band at the time called Horselips, who was slightly more into the Irish medieval sound. Thin Lizzy, though, you can hear it right. It's almost in their DNA, because even when you get past the Eric Bell lineup and you get to Brian Robertson and Scott Gorham and The Boys Are Back in Town and Jailbreak, you can hear those guitars.
Yeah. The melodies, right, yeah.
They're all these kind of shuffles that go right back to original Irish music.
It's a funny sort of unique character, really. We haven't talked much about the fact that he was a black man, which was unusual, I guess, in Dublin at the time.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, a black, illegitimate child of a white woman, single mother.
What was his parentage, do you recall?
His father was African Portuguese, and his name was Paris.
Yeah.
Which also, in a bizarre way, led to one of Lynott's most famous songs, credited to Gary Moore, Parisian Walkways.
Wow.
I remember Paris in 49. And the Paris was for him a little wordplay on his father's real name. But it was his mother that really brought Phil up, although he did spend some time with his grandparents on his mother's side. His mother worked in England. She wasn't able to look after a little baby.
Yeah.
So he had a difficult upbringing. I mean, at school, you know, Brian Downey, the Lizzy drummer who was at school with Lynott, told me that he was actually a very sensitive soul who got picked on, pushed around, and eventually snapped, stood his ground in one memorable playground fight at which Lynott had brought a knife against this horribly tough bully.
Yeah.
It didn't go beyond brandishing the knife, but it kind of stood his ground. And from then on, he took it as read that that was the way to deal with people. And by the time I knew Phil from about 77 onwards, 76 I first met him, but I got to know him better from about 77 onwards. He had this tough guy stance. He was one of his songs, I think, Warriors, he famously says, "My heart is ruled by Venus and my head by Mars." And that was very much him. You know, he was a very, very smooth, charming, svelte, bon vivant, particularly with, you know, the ladies. Mm. And then amongst the men, tough guy, real tough guy. He had massive, massive hands, which is partly why he was a good bass player, I guess. When I knew him, Thin Lizzy Roadies, when they came for the job, that have always been recommended by other roadies. So he knew they could do the lighting rig or whatever the hell roadies do. They were only ever asked one question, but it was always Lynott. He was the boss, always. And Lynott would ask them, can you fight?
Bloody hell.
And if they said yes, he was like, you're hired.
God.
So that whole boys are back in town thing, for Lynott, this was a... It wasn't a, you know, a bit of fun he had, you know, writing a song. It was it was an ethos. It was they were a very street, tough band.
I would have been really frightened if I'd ever met him.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
Oh no, he was
he quite tall?
Oh, very tall. Mm. Tall as a vampire.
Bloody hell.
But very funny. Yeah. Very charming.
Yeah. Let me tell you my story.
Yes, please. Does it involve the bass guitar or Glenn Hughes?
It involves Glenn Hughes, who I did a book with a few years ago. Now, the reason why Mick's laughing here is because I mentioned my friend Glenn Hughes.
You don't have to explain this, Charles.
For those of you who haven't been keeping
up. It doesn't matter if they don't know. Just carry on, mate.
So we're jumping forward, of course, as we always do when I get involved. But at some point, am I right, did not Gary Moore leave Thin Lizzy mid-tour in America?
He did in the summer of 1979.
He took it upon himself to fuck off right before a gig.
He did.
On the day. And where did he go for refuge?
Oh, to Glenn Hughes' place in New York.
In LA, I think.
Oh, in LA. Yeah, I bow to you in my...
That's all right.
When it comes to knowing Glenn Hughes' entire story.
He lived up in, you know, the Hollywood Hills near John Mayall and the rest of it. And that Laurel Canyon. Right
Laurel
up there.
Canyon,
right.
Yeah.
So Glenn is at home doing whatever he's doing on that particular day. And a knock on the door and it's Gary Moore, right? Gary Moore comes stumbling in and says, that's it, I've left Thin Lizzy. And Glenn, well, doesn't really know what to do, I suppose, and says, okay, fine, you know, want a drink? As he told me in the book, he said that you sort of didn't really argue with Gary Moore when it came to stuff like that. He had scars on his face for a reason, right? A couple of hours later, the phone rings, right? And it's fucking Lynott, like, not just angry, but experiencing biblical levels of rage.
Yeah, I bet.
And says, if you got Moore there, I'll fucking cut you. Or words to that
That's
effect.
Still Northern Irish.
Yeah.
try more for Dublin.
I do. If you've got... if
I'm Do you like Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah, but
I've perfected it.
He wasn't stoned.
If you've got more there...
I'll fucking cut you. Fucking throat.
Throat. You would have said throat.
Throat.
Cut your throat.
Cut your throat.
Throat.
Dennis, of course, shat himself. Didn't say, no, I haven't got Gary Moore. Bless him. You know, you can't blame him. Phone got hung up, and then the outcome was that was that. They had to get someone else in, which, well, I don't know, who was it?
It was Midge-Ure.
Midge-Ure, of course.
I mean, they should have got Brian Robertson in. But can I just say, the thing about that story that I've always found curious is Gary left Lizzy mid-tour because Gary was not a drug guy. You know, Gary was a boozer.
Yeah.
He wasn't a drug guy. Lynott and Gorham at that point were full-fledged
junkies. Smacked out, weren't they?
Full-fledged junkies. Gary couldn't stand it anymore, and that's the reason he left. And the bit of the story that always gets me is that having left Lynott and Gorham because they were such junkies, he goes to visit Glenn Hughes, himself one of the biggest junkies in the music business at that point.
Yeah. Unbelievable, really.
How does that work?
Oh, I don't know. And as we know, there were subsequent amazing adventures with Glenith and Gary went on to do crazy stuff together.
Well,
and you can read in the book, it's available on Amazon right now.
Yeah, that bit will be cut out.
So Lynott, then, not a man to cross or to encounter when in his rage.
Definitely not, no. I mean, he famously, and I was there for this, it was fantastic, actually, on their Black Rose tour. They had a big party in London at the end of it, and I was involved as a PR.
Yeah.
And in those days, the music press was paramount. You know, we didn't have endless TV channels and radio channels, certainly no social media. The music press was how you stayed connected and plugged in to your favourite bands. So they were very important. They were the gatekeepers. And, of course, all the most prominent ones were at this party. I'd be given a budget. I think it was about £4,000. No, a budget. You know what a budget is. Just because I didn't say low budget. You didn't quite get it, did you?
Budgets are what record companies used to have, right?
£4,000 I had to put on this party, which in 79 felt like a lot of dough.
Yeah.
I should have put it on at my place and kept the dough, but you live and learn.
One does.
So we're at the party and it's all going swimmingly well. Oceans of champagne and, you know... and.
What, everyone was ill?
I don't know if Glenn was there, but it was like that. And anyway, Alan Jones of the Melody Maker, these days kind of former editor of Uncut, a great writer, great figure in those days. He was one of those people who was very confrontational, but in a kind of a very humorous way. And but it got him into trouble, all sorts of trouble. And on this particular occasion, Lineup being Irish, could have a maudlin streak, And you get him on the right booze and the right moment, and he would start to talk to you about his people. Mm. I mean, he was a history buff. He knew about every well in Ireland. He'd tell you the story around it. The Battle of 1583 and the lairds that owned that hill. Yeah. And he knew everything. But he used to like to talk about my people. And Jonesy, who was Welsh, just, you know, fed up with hearing all this. Mm. And so Lynott's at the bar doing his, my people, you know, for hundreds of years, you know, persecuted, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And Jonesy goes, well, Phil, what people is that? The Paddies or the Blacks? And Phil went,
bang.
And Jonesy, literally, like in a cartoon, went, boom, 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 boom. And then there was a huge cheer. Wow. And then they lifted Jonesy up, took him back to the bar and gave him a bottle of champagne.
And all was well. Those were different times.
They were definitely different times, yeah.
Bloody hell.
Dead rock stars lobbing light grenades into the gloom.
Okay, cool. We've talked about him as a person not to be crossed. But what interested me earlier was that you talked about him as a sort of smooth, charming man who, you know, you could get on with.
Absolutely.
Always fascinates me. And it's a recurring theme in these podcasts as well, you know. We tend to talk about people who have multiple sort of parts to their nature.
Well,
actually,
definitely.
What makes them interesting, right?
No, of course. I mean, wouldn't it be awful if the only Lynott was the boorish one that, of legend, you know? I mean, as I say, he was a poet.
A bit like you.
He was a poet, not like me. He was a published poet, although I have had some poetry published. But
have you written poetry?
Yeah, I have, actually.
Does it rhyme?
No.
Talk a bit about Lizzie and specifically...
I didn't finish what you last asked me to talk about. Cheers. Yeah, when I listen to these podcasts, which I try not to, it's full of you going, here's a question, interrupting me before I get a chance to fucking answer it.
I've honed my... I must butt in here.
No, he was a good man.
A good man.
Stop talking and I'll tell you. He married Caroline Crowther. They had two beautiful daughters. And he was a great guy to go and visit in his days when, you know, he'd wear a white suit and gold jewellery and play the gentleman at home.
Yeah.
You know, he was like an Irish David Niven, you know.
When would this have been?
Late 70s. Mm. I mean, the whole heroin thing really came in around 78, 79, but it wasn't unique to Phil Lynott at all. I mean, it was just prevalent. It wasn't really until... the early 80s when Thin Lizzy broke up. Those were the really dark days. Mm. And I guess we should go there because...
Well, hang on, we'll get there.
Oh, okay.
I want to stay with the good times just for a moment.
Okay.
And specifically, I'd like to ask about Scott Gorham, who I've met a few times and liked. Mm. Hell of a musician. I think he did a good job with the resurrected Thin Lizzy, briefly, not so long ago.
The twin guitarist thing in Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
I once was talking to Scott, this was a few years after Phil died, and I said to Scott, you must have got really sick of the fact that you kept losing guitarists.
Yeah.
You know, you were solid right the way through. It was always the other guy. And the fact is, when it came to Brian Robertson, Phil sacked him. He sacked him twice. Mm. So bad he sacked him twice. Not because he wasn't a great player or didn't have a great part of the Lizzy identity.
Yeah.
But I then went on to work with Robbo. I was 21 and he was 23. And I got to tell you, he was out of control.
With the booze?
With everything. Robbo, you know, you'd say to Robbo, do you want a drink? And he'd go, yeah, I have a quadruple tequila.
Mm.
And you'd bring that back and he'd wallop that and go, well, I have another one now, you know. He and Jimmy Bain used to come into our office and a bottle of brandy later, they'd go off again.
I'm sure it's not recommended.
Well, that plus all the coke and smack and weed and cigarettes and... it was endless.
It's definitely not recommended in Men's Health magazine that I read.
No, but then talk to Jimmy Page, talk to Keith Richards. Mm. I mean, Francis Rossi of Status Quo, who isn't dead yet, told me just the other day when I was talking to him that in his alco phase, he'd go to the bar, order six tequilas, knock them back, then order six more, knock them back, then order six more, and that would be the tray he would take to the table to sit down and have a drink.
It's no wonder there's such a long list of dead rock stars for us.
There
to
you
talk
go.
About,
you know. There you go. So Robbo got sacked.
Yeah.
Gary Moore came in.
Yeah.
Gary was the complete opposite to Robbo. He wasn't a drug guy. He was a booze hound. But he was also a virtuoso guitarist.
Yeah.
And he'd known Phil from the year dot. And Gary fired himself. Robbo got fired twice. Gary Moore left Thin Lizzy twice. Mm. Twice, because he just couldn't bear being with Phil anymore and seeing him kill himself.
It was specifically Phil's drug use that was putting him off.
Absolutely. Yeah, towards the end of his life, when they did that single Out in the Fields.
Which is killer, by the way. Which
is
song.
Which is a great song. Yeah. But that was Gary trying to rescue Phil. Mm. Gary told me that while they were doing that session, Phil would have his heroin dealer come round to the studio every day. And he said one time, he said the lowest point it got was when his wife was working that day or something, yeah. So he had his little child with him.
Oh, no.
And the little child and the dealer went into the toilet with Lina.
Oh, please.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Dead Rock Stars. Memento Mori from Momentous Mortals.
Did Lizzie's fortunes wax and wane in the time when they were famous? Was it a gentle thing for them? Was it a sudden sort of massive leap to fortune with the live album? As you perceived it, Mick, how did it go for them?
No, no, not at all. I mean, these are the days when record companies would sign an artist and build a career over three or four albums. The fact that they got good press was a huge encouragement. So it meant that they could always do shows at colleges and clubs. They'd always get well reviewed. You know, they were favourites of people like Charles Shaw Murray and The Enemy. Nick Kent famously did a great cover story on them around the time of the Black Rose album. Sounds and Melody Maker, very supportive. So they always had a profile, but it wasn't, you know, they were considered deeply unfortunate because Whiskey in the Jar was a hit and it was a novelty hit. And you don't really come back from those. To continue the Bowie comparison, imagine if Bowie's first hit had been The Laughing Gnome. You know, it would be very hard to then come back with, you know, The Man Who Sold the World. Thin Lizzy had a similar problem. Mm. All that saved them was the fact that they already were established album artists, and the fact that Eric Bell left so soon after the success of Whiskey allowed Lynott to reconfigure the band, new label, new management, just relaunch the whole thing with the two guitars, and that became their signature sound.
Dueling guitars. In the era of punk, how is it that Thin Lizzy, who played fairly unreconstructed rock music, crossed over and were successful and impressed the punk-obsessed critics of the day?
Because they all loved Thin Lizzy. You know, they weren't considered Black Sabbath or Led Zeppelin. For a start, they had hit singles. Mm. Secondly, they had Lynott. You know, Lynott was a judge on Miss World. You know, Lynott would turn up on talk shows. Lynott was a tough dude.
Parallels with Lemmy? The punks love Motörhead too?
Yeah, no, very, very close parallels. In fact, the first time I ever met Lynott was when he was talking to Johnny Rotten after a show at the Hammersmith Odeon in 1976. They had a party afterwards. I wasn't yet in the business. I was somebody's plus one.
Yeah.
And it literally was. This is 76. Can you imagine? The boys are back in town. Has been a big hit. They're on their third night at Hammersmith Odeon. And there's this glamorous party.
Yeah.
And it's all Page Three girls and George Best and Alex
Dolly
Higgins.
Dolly Birds.
And all that stuff. And the guy that took me, Pete Makowski, a famous rock writer, he's talking to Phil, and I'm just standing there like you do, like a pillar, you know, not knowing anybody.
Like a fifth wheel.
Absolutely. And this horrible guy, I'd never heard of the Sex Pistols. Anarchy in the UK hadn't been released. Yeah. There wasn't anything going on yet that I would have heard of.
Yeah.
And this horrible creature, all hunched over with weird gelatined orange hair and looking like a rat, you know, came over. Oh, Phil, I'm so fucking bored.
Oh,
and Phil was like, ah, fuck off, Johnny. Yeah. Go and pull yourself a board. And he's like, oh, all right, Phil, but I fucking hate this shit. And he wandered off. And I said to Pete, who was that awful guy?
Mm-hmm.
And Pete went, oh, that was Johnny Rotten. And I went, Johnny what? He said, no, that's his name. He's in a group called the Sex Pistols. I remember thinking, well, that's the first and last I'll ever hear of
right.
them.
This will be a fad.
Yeah. A month later, of course, I was buying the single. But Lynott wasn't a hair down to the waist heavy metal guy.
Yeah.
He had an afro.
Yeah.
This wasn't Pink Floyd we're talking about or Led Zeppelin. This was Lizzy. And, of course, Lynott, like Lemmy, who was one of his best friends, was out at the clubs every single night. So people like Steve Jones and Paul Cook just kissed his ass.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Great. Man, I love the picture you're building of this man, a complex individual, but a good bloke to be around.
Well, Bob Geldof was a so-called punk in those days with the Boomtown Rats, also an Irishman.
Yeah.
And he told a great story where he told me he went round to Lynott's house in Richmond with Paula Yates, who was Geldof's girlfriend at the time. And he said, and Lynott gave him some smack.
Yeah.
Geldof passed out in the other room and Phil's like, come on, Bob, I'll put you in my room, you know, and lies him on the bed. He said, meantime, Phil then takes Paula into the other room
and
tries to get off with her, yeah.
Oh.
Knowing Paula, I doubt he tried very hard.
No. Did you know her?
I did.
Interesting.
She used to sit there in the Record Mirror office and she used to do a column for them with no knickers on and a really short skirt and she'd sit on the desk at eye level. And then everybody had to pretend not to look.
Different times. Different times.
Well, you say that, but I bet, you know, Justin Bieber is somewhere right now doing something like that. Is he someone that's cool with the kids? Is he alive? Will he be on this programme one day?
Well, he may be. Whether we will be is a whole other kettle of fish. It's interesting, isn't it? Honour among thieves, almost, is what you're referring to there. Lynott feeling perhaps a touch of reticence.
Well... I don't even know if there was a touch of reticence. I think it was more a case of, look, he's passed out. We could do a quickie. What's the harm?
Opportunity. These good
times. Can I tell you another thing?
I'll talk to my producer. Yes, you may.
He's not the boss. He's your producer,
I've said this before. What I love it is the way you say, can I say something? And I always go, well, maybe you can.
Yeah.
Did anyone try and step in and save him? Did Lemmy come round and have a word? You know, that kind of thing. Did anyone help out? I'm not sure it's known, you know.
I don't know if they did. I mean, these days, we're much more accustomed to the idea of intervention.
Yeah.
Or actually, it's a bit like cigarettes. You know, if I was to light up a cigarette right now, there would be outrage in the entire building, okay? The period we're talking about, if you didn't smoke, people would say, oh, why is that then?
On a health kick, are you?
Well, not even that, but they're just genuine bafflement. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't smoke.
You must be a singer.
Yeah, perhaps you've got an allergy or, you know...
Sure.
You know, I feel sorry for you. This guy doesn't smoke. The thought of someone going to Phil and saying, hey, Phil, I think you're kind of hitting it a little bit too hard. Just... Those people wouldn't be invited home.
No, I'm with you. As we say each time, don't we? Different times, different vibes. Did you know Phil in this sad phase of his life?
I did. In fact, I visited him about a month before he died.
Crikey. Tell us about that.
He was very ill. I mean, he was very bloated, pouring with sweat. But I'd kind of got used to that. He'd been like that for a few years. I mean, every time I saw him, it was like, oh, he's got the flu, you know.
Was Lynott doing anything productive at this point?
He had released a single called 19, which... essentially was, well, ZZ Top are doing really, really well with a synthesized guitar sound. I'll do the same.
Yeah.
He did a really lame video in LA for which he was so out of it, he could barely sit on his motorcycle. He came home and by then Caroline, his wife, had moved out, taken the girls away. You can barely blame her. I mean, you know, she'd been gone a couple of years at this point.
Mm.
But he still had that kind of slightly defiant, cheeky sense of humour.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I asked him this. I think because it was a very sort of melancholy moment.
Yeah.
Everything about him at that point seemed a bit Miss Havisham. You know, it was all kind of, here's my gold records from 5 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
And for some odd reason, I said, Phil, do you regret not making it in America? Because they kept blowing their chances. The Boys Are Back in Town was a big hit single in America.
Yeah.
Jailbreak became a chart album, the album the song was taken from. They went to tour and they cancelled because Lynott got hepatitis. They came back, regrouped, did the Johnny the Fox album, which he wrote most of the songs for while in hospital with hepatitis from Dirty Needles. They were about to go out back out on tour beginning of 77 with Queen. It was billed as the Queen Lizzie tour. Robbo gets in a fight with Frankie Miller on Frankie Miller's side at the speakeasy, cuts a tendon in his hand, can't play guitar. That tour gets cancelled and then rearranged with Gary Moore stepping in.
Yeah.
And then Last Chance Saloon in the summer of 79, when they're opening for Journey, who were big at that point in America. Gary Moore fucks off mid-tour and blows the whole gaff. And at that point, every promoter in America, their record label, Cliff Bernstein, who was working for Mercury, their American record label, who then went on to manage Def Leppard, who were Thin Lizzy devotees,
you know,
Metallica, all these people said to me, it broke my heart. You know, when they blew it yet again in America, we pretty much at Mercury all just went, you know what, fuck it. These guys are their own worst enemies.
Yeah.
So cut to 6 years later for some stupid reason. And I think I was cringing even as it came out of my mouth. But I said, Phil, do you regret not making it in America? And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, but don't I regret not fucking Kate Bush? And I thought, well, you know.
Defiant till the end.
Phil's philosophy in a nutshell.
Had he lost hope then? I mean, is it just...
No, he was completely in denial. I mean, Scott told me that Scott went home to California and got clean.
Yeah.
Came back a year later and went to visit Phil around this time at his house in Richmond and said to Phil, look, let's get the band back, but you've got to get clean.
Yeah.
And Lynott was always, absolutely, absolutely, first thing tomorrow. It was always like that. And then do you know the story of you know, the last night of Phil's life?
No, I don't.
Well, this involves our other old dead rock star chum, Jimmy Bain. And it's a ghastly story, which I'm going to keep to the minimum. But, you know, Jimmy was a huge smackhead, but he was this very slightly built, elfin-like guy who had the capacity of a tank, you know. But he and Lynott were friends. They'd co-written together on some of the Lynott solo albums, and they had what you'd call a big night at the house. It was just after Christmas.
Yeah.
Big night, from which Phil turns blue, goes into a blackout.
Yeah.
The organs in his body at that point were collapsing one by one. And Jimmy, with the constitution of a buffalo, survives the night, fucks off in the morning and leaves Phil there.
Crikey.
I think made a phone call to Phil's mum just to say, you might want to go round there. And then you get this bizarre set of circumstances where Phil's mum turns up with Caroline and they decide not to take him to the hospital or call 999, but to get him to some private health clinic miles outside of London.
Yeah. He was still alive at this point.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, the only reason I can think of was because he was big in the tabloids at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, he was really... It reminded me of that guy that used to be with Kate Moss. What was his name, that little shit?
Pete Doherty.
Yeah. Always in the papers for the wrong reasons. Yeah. That was Lynott by the end. And I can't help thinking maybe if we dial 999, the police will come,
chaos,
blah, blah, blah. So they decided to go private, as all rock stars did and do.
Yeah.
You know, these days you go to the Priory, you know, pay thousands of pounds so you don't have to, you know, deal with it in public.
Yeah.
They didn't have that then, so they had this other thing. And, of course, it didn't help. You know, he died. There is one last story, which may be apocryphal, but knowing Phil, I kind of doubt it.
Go on.
Apparently, almost his very last words to the nurse that was in the room with him, and I was told this by a guy called Big Charlie, who was what they called your Percy, your personal roadie. Charlie's now dead too, for the same reasons. Lynott called the nurse over. Come here, darling, come here. And she leans up. She was only 36, don't forget.
Yeah.
She leans over and he says in her ear, I suppose a wank's out of the question.
I'm going to say right now that is apocryphal, but it's brilliant.
I don't think
you,
it is.
You think it bears some investigation?
Well, apparently he also asked Charlie the same question. So I think the man was in desperate need of something.
Clearly
if
he
it was just a pillow over his face.
Bloody hell.
Yeah. So he died of multiple organ failure at the age of 36. And when you see all these people like David Coverdale,
yeah,
and Joe Elliott and all these people now cleaning up in the classic rock market, it's obvious that if he'd just taken that year, 3 months, whatever, to get clean, no, Lizzie would have come back and
yeah,
we'd still be talking about them today.
But you know what? He really did just miss that boat, because it must have been, what, 84 when Motley Crue cleaned up? Aerosmith cleaned up.
Well, Aerosmith cleaned off, the year after.
So it was all happening,
yeah,
at that time. As I understand it, management was starting to be pissed off with all these people who are dying or incapacitated all the time, and said, we will not invest this money and time in you,
right,
until you start cleaning up, which is why there was this large wave of cleaning up. I'm not saying it was a pretty thing to watch. It was quite nauseating at the time.
Well, Motley Crue was 89.
Oh, it was late as that.
Yeah.
But for sure, there was a movement towards that, right?
Well, we were entering the era we're in now, where you actually had facilities and people,
yeah,
to do this, and
yeah,
you actually had people, you know, you saw some of these people in the Metallica movie, psychologists and
yeah,
Bon Jovi, when they broke up, got back together 2 years later because they brought in a group psychologist who,
yeah,
sat them all down in a room for several months, and they worked through their issues.
Perhaps Phil was one of the last rock stars to succumb to these habits before this general idea that you could be helped out of this thing professionally became part of the conversation in rock music.
Well, maybe, but you know, Steve Clark of Def Leppard died in 91 of similar causes.
Sure.
Mm. Addiction is addiction, whatever the year, whatever the time and,
yeah,
place.
Yeah.
You know, the problem with a lot of these guys as well, I think, and Steve Clark used to talk to me and tell me, he's someone else we're doing another episode,
yeah,
but he used to say to me, one of the biggest problems he had going into rehab was when you sit around in the circle and do your group meeting,
yeah,
everybody else would have these dreadful stories of how they reached bottom.
Yeah.
And his dreadful story would be, well, I've just done Madison Square Garden. And, you know, Jason Bonham told me that when he first went into rehab, and you know, Jason's very ebullient and,
yeah,
you know, out there guy, the counsellor took him aside and said, Jason, look, when you tell your story at these meetings, can you tone it down a bit? Because because when you tell the story of you reach rock bottom the night you found yourself in Vegas with a bottle of champagne,
yeah,
in each hand and an ounce of Coke and $50,000, he said,
yeah,
it just... There's people here envious of you.
It diminishes everyone else's,
yeah,
experience.
They're not going, wow, that's terrible. They're,
yeah,
going, shit,
yeah,
maybe,
okay,
it ain't so bad.
Yeah, right. Where did it all go right?
Yeah.
Well, we tend to wind these things up, do we not, by awarding stars out of 5 various criteria, almost all of which are completely tasteless and dreamt up by our producer. And the first one is, I believe, a legacy, the legacy of Lynott. As I understand it, the Thin Lizzy brand still exists. I'm not sure whether it's a global force to be reckoned with. People still talk, do they not, in hushed tones about their finest records and their best tours.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
But, I mean, frankly, he died decades before his time and, you know, perhaps with his life's work not done. I don't know. What's your view?
Definitely a talent wasted. Once he got into heroin during the Black Rose album and thereafter, they never made a good record again. Their final record, Thunder and Lightning, was a good album, but by then they had their last great guitarist in the band, John Sykes,
yeah,
whose very next move was to join Whitesnake, where he co-writes with Coverdale the 1987 album, which becomes one of the biggest selling albums
here
of the 80s.
Again.
Well, he didn't write that. That was Bernie Marsden.
No, I just broke into song.
Yeah,
can I not do that?
Wrong song. Well, John Sykes co-wrote all of the album, apart from that track,
yeah,
all of the album with Coverdale, and that, as I say, became one of the biggest selling albums of the 80s.
Stop laughing.
So the Thunder and Lightning album was a good album. He had young blood. Sykes was great guitarist, dynamic looking, not a drug guy.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, Lynott threw it away. You know, he was, at one point, he was going to star in a biopic about Jimi Hendrix.
Mm.
He had an opportunity to become a solo star, You know, yeah. Rod Stewart's manager, Billy Gaff, was interested in managing him. But everybody threw in the towel once they spent any time with him in those years because he just was a terrible, terrible West. It's one of the reasons that prevented Lemmy becoming a bigger star. You know, people go on about Lemmy being this outlaw.
Yeah.
That's all he was left with at the end because his opportunities to do an Ozzy Osbourne
yeah.
always got frittered away.
Yeah, fucking hell, man. All right, so what did we say? Marks out of five for his legacy.
Well, you look at Def Leppard, you know, you look at Bon Jovi, who always did the Boys Are Back in Town as yeah. an uncle. You look at Shrek, Boys Are Back in Town. I would say, I'm going to say four. I'm going to say four
Sounds
because,
reasonable. You know.
Because he was a great songwriter.
Mm. Did you like Metallica's version of Whiskey in the Jar?
I absolutely hated it.
Really?
I thought it was the biggest pile of shite yeah. I've ever heard. Especially that bit where Hetfield starts talking about Whack for My Daddy.
Yeah, that makes my balls shrink.
It really pisses me off.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
it's
strange choice.
You would have thought they'd have got the lyrics at least.
Yeah.
You know, the line, of course, is Wake for My Daddy.
God.
Wake, but with an Irish accent.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Whack for My Daddy. Oh, hell yeah.
At one point, Hetfield goes, Oh, whiskey.
It's like, please,
do you think he ever heard?
Stop improvising,
James. Did he ever hear Thin Lizzy? Do you think? Do you know Metallica? Actually,
no, he was a huge Lizzy fan. I'm sure of it.
Kirk Hammett told me that, and I can't remember which bloody track it is. One of their early tracks was ripped off from a Thin Lizzy song. But we're going down a side alley.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. we'll come to yeah. it. Okay, what about his star quality?
Five.
Like Freddie, did he light up the room when he walked through the door?
100%. I would say more than Freddie. Freddie had a propensity to want to hide sometimes, whereas Liner, no, baby. You know,
amazing.
You know the reason he held his bass. You as a bassist, you might know this. Why he held his bass so
it
high?
Was so people could see his cock.
Well, no, he used
so
to.
So the women could see his cock.
Exactly. He used to have two spotlights.
One for each
hitting
ball.
His crutch. So it was just this whole area.
Again, one for each ball.
Possibly, although I think it was more the thing in the middle that caused
mirrored,
the stir.
He put the mirrored scratch plate on his bass so he could shine it at people, which is slightly less less rock star-ish, but nonetheless.
Yeah.
All right, good. Taste for excess.
Oh, five.
All right, yeah, okay. And this is something that our producer always puts in. I fundamentally disagree with it. I'm going to say it anyway. Marks out of five for death as a career move. No, I'm going to say zero.
Yeah, I'm going to say zero.
You know, it fucking messed up his career, the future career that he could have had.
Yeah. I loved Phil. He was the lucky black cat for such a long time.
Yeah.
But boy, did he fuck it at the end.
And that, listeners, is today's lesson.
Don't Thank fuck it listening. At the end.
Try not to fuck it at all, let alone at the end.
Especially at the end, though. Because if you fuck it at the beginning, you can still come back from that.
Anyway, so how do we get to the next dead rock star?
Both Liner and our next dead rock star were the leaders in their bands. Liner, overtly, the other more covertly.
Oh, that is good.
In fact, our next dead rock star's band actually covered Thin Lizzy, but only after Liner had died. And both recorded albums with lightning in the title. Liner's was his very last album, and Joel?
Yes?
Our next dead rock star's was his second to last.
Bear that in mind, people, and thank you very, very much for tuning in. We will see you next week. Any final words about the great Liner, Mick?
Any girls out there with a bit of Irish in them? Any girls out there like a little bit more Irish in them?
As he used to say on stage.
You heard it here. This has been a 7 Digital production. Thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate it. Please share the heck out of our podcast, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye!
Hell yeah!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.